Welcome to this Forthright Radio for February 20th, 2013. I'm Joy LeClaire. Do we ever have a full show for you today? With us are Richard Heinberg and Robert Dietz. We will be discussing the difficult issues of rampant and pernicious global economic system of growth that more and more people say is destroying the very biosphere on which we humans are utterly dependent for our survival. And not only that, but we're going to be discussing how to create a sustainable economic system that addresses the many destructive elements of the so-called free market capitalist system. And since we have two guests, we won't be able to take your phoned-in questions, but you can email me at forthrightradio@gmail.com, and I'll try to incorporate them into our discussion. That's forthrightradio@gmail.com. Richard Heinberg is no stranger to our KZYX and Z listeners. Over many years, and through his 10 books, including The Party's Over, Peak Everything, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, Richard Heinberg is widely regarded as one of the world's most effective communicators of the urgent need to transition away from fossil fuels as well as other limited resources. He is senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute, and he is a major new contributor to a new, he's a major contributor to a new book that the Post Carbon Institute has put out called Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. We welcome you back to the KZYX and Z airwaves, Richard Heinberg.
Well, thank you, Joy. It's very good to be talking with you.
Well, we are very appreciative of your work and that you have taken the time to join us today. Also joining us is Robert Dietz, who has co-written with British economist Dan O'Neill, Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Robert Dietz is the editor of the Daily News and the former executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, which we'll be hearing more about from him during the show. Noam Chomsky says about his book, Enough is Enough, quote, "Humans seem to be intent on confirming the argument of biologist Ernest Mayr that higher intelligence may be a lethal mutation, but the grim prognosis is not inevitable. This lucid, informed, and highly constructive book shows that with the will to act, solutions can be found to build a steady state economy geared to meeting human needs." Welcome also to Forthright Radio, Robert Dietz.
Thanks so much, Joy. It's great to be here and great to be on with Richard. You're a hero of mine, Richard, as you already know.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I think Richard's a hero to a lot of people. Well, anyway, gentlemen, through shows such as the Renewable Energy Hour, Wild Oak Living, TUC Radio, that stands for Time of Useful Consciousness, the Farm and Garden Show, the Ecology Hour, as well as Forthright Radio, KZYX and Z listeners have had many years of education and discussion about peak energy and peak resources, the rapid destruction of the biosphere. So I'm hoping that today's discussion, we can focus more on the where do we go from here question and how do we get there. And although I'll be asking each of you specific questions, I hope that you'll both feel free to make this a discussion and feed off of each other's answers and not wait for me to ask you a direct question.
Richard, sure, sounds good.
Yeah, it works well. It works well. Richard Heinberg, let's begin with you. In this latest book from the Post Carbon Institute, Lester Brown quotes Paul Hawkins, and I think it is a wonderful summary. Here's the quote. "At present, we are stealing the future, selling it in the present, and calling it gross domestic product. We can just as easily have an economy that is based on healing the future instead of stealing it. We can either create assets for the future or take the assets of the future. One is called restoration and the other exploitation." That's the end of the quote. And then Lester Brown continues, "The larger question is, if we continue with business as usual, with overpumping, overgrazing, overplowing, overfishing, and overloading the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, how long will it be before the Ponzi economy unravels and collapses? No one knows. Our industrial civilization has not been here before. That's the end of the quote. And elsewhere in the book, someone says something like, the coming age will be as different from our current age as the agricultural age was from the Industrial Revolution. Part of our problem is vision. Richard, what are some of the elements of your vision of this coming age? Let's start small, right?
Sure. Yeah, you know, the 20th century was really all about fossil fuels, and particularly oil. And it drove growth like we've never seen it before. A paper came out just last year, 2012, by Robert Gordon, published by the National Institute of Economic Research. It's really a landmark paper. It got a lot of discussion among economists. Most of them really didn't know what to do with it, though, because it was so far outside their current belief system. But what Gordon did was he looked at GDP growth over the last several decades and tied it to the fundamental drivers. And what he discovered was that there have been three basic periods of economic growth. The first was tied to coal and railroads, mostly the 19th century, early 20th century. The second period was driven mostly by oil and all of the transportation that was enabled by oil, cars, airplanes, and so on, and electrification. This was also the same period of time when houses were getting electricity and people were buying their first electric appliances. And then the third period of economic growth is the most recent one, starting in the 1970s and 80s, led primarily by computerization, cell phones, the internet, and so on. What he found was that it was that second period that was driven by cheap oil and electrification that brought with it by far the lion's share of economic growth. So even though you know, we're still inventing more stuff all the time, and the latest iPhone is way cooler than the last one, and so on. The actual economic growth we're seeing now is relatively trivial compared to what we got in the mid 20th century, and there are basic structural reasons for that. We can't assume that more technology is going to bring us basically back to the days of the Beverly Hillbillies and, you know, the 1960s. It's just not likely to happen. So that means the 21st century is going to look very different from the 20th century, and we should be assuming that the 21st century is not going to be, you know, more economic expansion like we've seen in the past. We're going to be less mobile because oil is going to be more expensive, more scarce as time goes on. And therefore, the whole process of globalization that we saw occur over the course of the last few decades is probably going to run in reverse, more localization. Those are the basic parameters that we're looking at in this century. And then it's up to us to fill in the dots. You know, what's the transition going to look like? Is it going to be just sort of the failure of our current institutions, you know, Wall Street collapsing and airlines going broke and, you know, et cetera, and everybody else just kind of, you know, losing their jobs and sort of like 2008 only every year and worse every time? Or are we going to sort of understand that why this is happening and get out ahead of the curve and begin localizing our economies and building local economic institutions, cooperatives, credit unions, and all the rest, that are going to be able to carry us into a new steady state economy, which is what Rob writes about.
Rob, do you want to take it from there? Rob Dietz?
Yeah, sure. I agree. That's a tall order of a question, but I'll take a stab at it. When we become accustomed to something and it becomes normal in our lives, it seems like it's very difficult to picture something else. And, you know, when I was a kid, I used to bond with my dad by watching movies. We had HBO, and we'd sit there in a den watching movies. But I'd always be lying pretty much face down on the floor to watch. And the reason was I was trying to stay beneath the pall of smoke that was coming off of the cigars that he was that he was smoking. And at that time, smoking indoors, smoking in cars, even on planes, in restaurants, it was completely common. And we've had a cultural shift since then that was due to better understanding of the effects of smoking. And I think that's what's beginning to happen right now with growth. Richard's book, The End of Growth, is one that that demonstrates that we're reaching the end of the time where continuous economic growth is normal. So the question of, well, what are we going to do? What will life be like? The way I've thought about it is, once we let go of the idea that we have to grow the economy, once we knock out the growth imperatives that are built into our current set of institutions, well, it opens up all kinds of different things that we can do. And one of the things that Dan and I put together in Enough is Enough, our book, is a kind of a list of 10 scenarios of how things will be different. And a lot of the difference, I think, really is almost a shift from the frantic pursuit of more to a calming satisfaction with enough. Instead of always chasing after more jobs, more income, more consumption, more stuff, we go to enough jobs, enough income, enough consumption, and enough stuff. And that has huge effects all over the map of day-to-day life. For example, you can imagine in family life, households would be emphasizing healthy lifestyles and relationships. And with a shorter work week, we could spend more quality time with one another and explore personal development. Maybe we pick up a musical instrument a little bit more often, or we can learn that language we've always wanted to pick up, watch a sunset, basically ending that lament that you hear people say, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. And you can run through all different sectors, whether it's community life, businesses, cities, agriculture, nature. That's a really important one, is nature. Without a continuously growing economy crowding out nature, our lands and waters can enter a new era of healing. People can enjoy more opportunities for outdoor recreation. And, wildlife becomes more abundant, and restored ecosystems are capable of providing the services that we're in desperate need of, like climate regulation and food production and water purification. So I'm excited that if we can let go of this obsession with growth, that we will start a new period where it's a period of healing and awakening.
That was Robert Dietz. His book is Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Rob, it was interesting that you began your point with your experience living with a smoker, because so many of the same tactics that the tobacco industry used to confuse the public or cast doubts on the health effects of tobacco are being used by those who do not want people to understand the urgency of climate change. And some of the things that happened to the tobacco industry maybe are necessary. For example, they're no longer allowed to advertise the way they used to. They're no longer to brainwash people about how glamorous smoking is and that sort of thing. And it occurs to me, one of the impediments to changing our culture, which both of your books say is crucial, is the influence of advertising. I think that in many ways, advertising serves the function of brainwashing. I would like to toss that out. And Richard, if you have any comments on that, you have the first opportunity.
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that.
Very good.
You know, a minute ago I was talking about how in the early 20th century we were riding on this wave of cheap oil and electrification. And what that did was, among other things, it made it easy to manufacture lots of stuff in enormous quantities and relatively quickly. We invented mass production, effectively. And the problem then in the early 20th century, from an economist's point of view, was overproduction. We could make this stuff faster than people could soak it up. So that is why the advertising industry came into being. It was a deliberate creation of the corporate world at that time to solve a problem, the problem of overproduction. And it worked. You know, we basically talked people into being different organisms. People were accustomed to being, you know, fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers and citizens. And we told them, no, you're not those things. You're consumers. So this is your job. Get busy. Consume as much stuff as you can. Buy stuff and use it up and throw it away because next year's model is going to be even better. That's what the corporate leaders were convinced was necessary in order to keep the economy growing, and growth became the be-all and end-all of economic existence. Well, we get to the 21st century, and we're in an entirely different situation. Resources are becoming more scarce. Energy is becoming more expensive. Oil prices are close to all-time highs. And it just doesn't make sense anymore to have an economy whose basic purpose is to take nature, grind it up, turn it into manufactured products, which have a shelf life of a few months and quickly, you know, populate landfills. That model of an economy, just if it ever made sense, it certainly doesn't make sense now. So advertising is an industry whose time is of usefulness, if it ever had one, is gone. And we'd be much better off today effectively banning advertising. I mean, information is one thing, but talking people into needing something that they didn't think they need previously, that makes no sense.
Rob, do you have any comments you want to add?
Yeah, I do, although I'm trying to get that mental image of a giant meat grinder grinding out nature into products out of my head. I agree with Richard. I mean, we've got to change what we're doing with advertising. It should be information-based, not generating an unnecessary want or desire. I mean, people have been discussing this, and it gets almost sickening. The business gurus, the brother team of Dan and Chip Heath, they wrote an essay about what's called stigma-based marketing. And the idea there is that the advertiser tries to create an insecurity or a social stigma among consumers in the hope of selling a product that promises relief for that stigma. An example is Procter & Gamble's strategy to sell shampoo in China. You know, dandruff was, at least prior to the ads getting going, it was a non-issue in Chinese culture. People didn't care about it. But Procter & Gamble ads painted dandruff as a social stigma, and of course a stigma that can be overcome by purchasing the company's product. So you can see that it's advertising is being used as a way to generate demand. And we know that we're all susceptible to it. If you start looking at the work of the behavioral economists, we know that we don't necessarily behave rationally and logically, and I know I'm susceptible to it too. And so therefore, my strategy, the strategy that a lot of families are using, is to avoid it as much as possible. But that's not really enough. I mean, in a culture that's saturated by advertisements, we've got to start figuring out how to clamp down on that. And in a way, I think of it as it would be very freeing. It would give us more choice if we had less advertisements to deal with. We'd be freed up from having all of this negative, these negative messages thrown right into our, in front of our faces and into our brains.
And yet so much of our entertainment and information, such as it is, whether it's television or print media or now internet, is the economic model seems dependent on advertising. So that's a very tricky one. But I think we've gotten the point on that. One of the bugaboos that's always raised anytime the discussion gets towards conservation or things around climate change, the XL pipeline is an excellent example of this. Even though there is a lot of very grassroots resistance to it, education behind it. There was a large demonstration in Washington, D.C. this Sunday about it that 350.org did. What always gets brought up and so far tends to trump is jobs. Rob Dietz, you started to talk about jobs. Let's think about that some more. And Richard Heinberg, of course, jump in wherever you want to on this. How do we turn the concepts about jobs around so that they promote life and not this death culture that we are accelerating?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Joy. I think jobs are probably the key issue when you're talking about economics. The politicians fight with each other over who can grow the economy fastest and who can create the most jobs. Well, one thing that we need to look at is growth, this idea of increasing GDP, producing and consuming more stuff, is that really our best strategy for creating and maintaining enough jobs and meaningful jobs? And I don't think that it is. It's a really blunt tool, first of all. You don't end up always succeeding. You can hear about jobless recovery. It's become a somewhat common term. So the idea there is, we've gotten the economy growing, but, hey, there's still widespread unemployment. So the idea is to figure out, how do we do this? How do we, as I said, create and maintain jobs in the absence of growth? And it's really fairly simple and I think a fairly desirable way, and that's to share the work around better, to decrease work time so that a lot of people are working more than 40 hours a week, and certainly 40 hours is our standard work week, and meanwhile there are a lot of people who can't find jobs, and so the idea is to make it more flexible, make it so that part-time jobs are more available and people can get by with them, and to have the work week reduced so that there's more ability to fill jobs with people that don't have them right now.
I would suggest maybe even stepping back a couple of steps and looking at the situation more in the abstract. I mean, maybe this is, maybe a lot of people would think this is really impractical, but hey, you know, a few decades ago, only a small percentage of the population had jobs. You know, this, jobs are not something that have existed for all time, and human beings have to have them in order for the world to work. It's a way of organizing people's time and the economy that we've created over the last few decades, and it worked in a certain context up to a point, but does everybody really like having a job in the sense of working for somebody else and having your time being sort of a commodity that you sell in exchange for money, which then you can exchange for, well, you know, like I said, it works within a certain context, but if you step back and look at it, maybe there are other ways of supplying human needs and getting the work done. One simple suggestion is, why don't we have, instead of, you know, privately owned or publicly traded corporations hiring everybody, why not more worker-owned co-ops? It's a different way of organizing the work, but it's one in which, rather than feeling like you're just being employed by a boss, everybody who's working is also a boss, and you can organize the work in a way that makes sense for everybody, and you feel a sense of agency and ownership for what you're doing. So, just a comment.
No, I agree completely with you, Richard. And the whole notion of the corporatocracy that we've got—that's a whole other area that we've got to see sweeping changes to. And I think your idea of democratizing workplaces is critical. And it's not only for changing the way we think of you know, sort of standard jobs, but also for other important factors for society, like making sure that the conditions with income and wealth are fair and that we end up with a more equitable society.
Right. You heard most recently from Robert Dietz. His most recent book is Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And also with us is Richard Heinberg. The Post-Carbon Institute, of which he is a senior research fellow, has recently published a huge book. It's a coffee table-sized book, very many photographs, called Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth. Richard, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I want to focus more on solutions, but you have for many years been warning us that renewables are not the panacea that many of us wish they were. Would you just spend a couple of minutes on talking about some of the issues around that?
Sure. That's one of the topics that we decided to tackle in this book, Energy. And by the way, I want to say just a few words about the book itself, because it's really remarkable, and listeners might want to check this out. It's available in several different forms, as the big coffee table book with all the photos. If you just want to see the photos, you can go on the internet and check them out. It's basically big full-page spreads of what it actually looks like, hydrofracking, tar sands, mountaintop removal. There are dozens and dozens of absolutely riveting photographs. You can find those on the internet at energy-reality.org, and that's a website for the book. The book is a compilation of pieces by people like Wendell Berry, Bill McKibben, Lester Brown, James Hansen, James Woolsey, Amory Lovins, and on and on. It's an effort at raising the energy literacy of readers and bringing more energy literacy to our national discussion about this, you know, this core subject. One of the problems that we tackled in putting this book together was this very question of renewable energy. Clearly, we're using the wrong energy sources today. Fossil fuels primarily, 85% of our energy, and of course, fossil fuels are undermining our future because of climate change. They're also non-renewable, so as we extract them from the ground, that means there's less there for future generations to use, however they would choose to use them, and we're depleting the best stuff first. So as time goes on, this is a big economic problem also. So we need to transition away from fossil fuels, no brainer. But can we just substitute renewables, you know, unplug the coal power plant and plug in a wind turbine in kind of a one-to-one scenario where basically we don't even know the difference? You know, one year we're driving gasoline-powered cars, the next year we're driving electric cars, and everything goes on as it was before, the economy keeps growing and so on. Well, actually, no. Renewable energy sources have different characteristics, and one of those characteristics is they take more land and, in many cases, more water as well. Think about an oil well, conventional oil well drilled back in the 1930s, very small footprint, just a pinprick on the Earth's surface, and yet producing this enormous amount of energy. To replace that energy with solar or wind, you'd need acres and acres, maybe hundreds of acres, of solar panels and mirrors or wind turbines and so on. So even though wind and sun are free and renewable and environmentally benign, our ways of capturing renewable energy involve technology and resources and environmental impacts. So what we really have to think about is not just changing our energy sources, but also changing the way we use energy, how much energy we actually use. And this is one of the main points of the book. We need to have a national conversation, not just about our energy sources, but about our energy consumption. In the book, we suggest that, you know, what this is the real core of what we should be talking about. And as we do, we get down to some really basic issues like what's more important, economic growth or a beautiful environment? You know, it really comes down to that kind of basic question.
Yes, each of you in your books stress, which I think usually gets left out of the discussion, the urgent need for beauty in our world, and that beauty is one of the criteria to judge whether an ecosystem is healthy or not. And I think that was, I'm not used to seeing that in this discussion. We have a question from one of our listeners that came via email, and you can email at forthrightradio@gmail.com. The first one is, how does exponential population growth factor into the ability to realize any of your proposals for a fix? And then the second one is, the ideas are great, but can you talk about the possibility of actually implementing them? What are the necessary steps? Robert, why don't you tackle that? Don't spend a lot of time. We've done so many shows on the population growth factor. I think we'll just stipulate that it's horrible and it complicates everything, and at the same time means we've got to hurry up and do it because it is exponential population growth.
Yeah, with, you know, a steady state economy, its simplest definition means that you have a stable number of people consuming a stable amount of materials and energy. And so, yeah, we've got to stabilize our numbers, no question about it. And the key there is, how do we do it in the most compassionate, least coercive way possible? And I'd just like to throw out one thing that, you know, the population of the planet is increasing by about 80 million people a year. And by coincidence, the number of births from unplanned pregnancies is about 80 million. So we've got a huge opportunity right there with better family planning, with better education to move very rapidly towards stabilizing our population. On the second question of, you know, these ideas are good, and how do we make headway on them? How do we implement them? Well, in Enough is Enough, we propose kind of a three requirements that you've got to have. The first is you need to have widespread recognition that our planet is finite, and that we've got to have an economy that respects that. I think for your listeners, Joy, and obviously for people who have read Richard's work, we're there. We recognize that, but it's not in the mainstream yet. It's still all about growth. The second thing that we need is we need to have this set of practical policies floating around. We need people to understand that there is an alternative, and that it's a good alternative and something that can work for us. You know, you're not going to get people supporting a transition unless they think what's at the end of the transition is going to meet their needs. And the third thing we need is a strong will to act. We're, you know, the entrenched elites, the corporate power, those things, you know, they're not going to give up their power very easily, and it's going to take, a concerted, organized effort to move forward with the transition. And I will also say this: I think it's going to be driven by crisis. The changes to our economic system are going to happen because of crises in the current system, and you might look at it as, I guess, putting a positive spin on it. The good thing is we're likely to have a whole lot of crises coming down the pike soon, and that will give us an opportunity. But we've got to have that widespread awareness of our planet's finite nature, and that we need an economy to match.
I have to confess that I read both of your books at the same time, so there's a little bit of confusion in my mind where some of my quotes are coming from, but I think it was Enough is Enough. There's a Milton Friedman quote about crisis, and that the trick of it is to have structures theoretically ready to be implemented when crisis occurs. And, of course, Naomi Klein wrote a whole book on crisis catastrophe, about that very subject, but it occurs to me
she calls it disaster capitalism.
Thank you. That's it. Yeah.
And I can. It's funny to be quoting Milton Friedman because he'd probably be one of the last people to support the kind of economy that Richard and I are talking about. But his quote is, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable."
Well, ideas with this last crisis economically, the 2008, the ideas were there. The money even was there. We gave the money to the banks instead of doing something similar to the, the work programs during the Great Depression, which would have done so much in terms of environmental restoration, infrastructure restoration, that sort of thing. But what was lacking? The political will? Either of you?
Yeah. Well, a postmortem on 2008 would be that the institutional power of Wall Street was so great that they effectively prevented any real change to the system. Obviously, Nobody in Wall Street went to jail. The banking rules were not changed. The banks were not re-regulated. The banks were judged too big to fail. So rather than breaking up the banks, those too big to fail banks are actually even bigger today than they were in 2007. So yeah, you're absolutely right. That crisis was an opportunity that was largely lost. That doesn't mean that it wasn't taken advantage of in other smaller ways. Communities around the country now understand that they are more vulnerable than they had realized, and there's more of an understanding of the need for resiliency and for economic alternatives. So in many places around the country, we've seen just since 2008 the flourishing of more cooperative institutions, businesses, smaller banks, local credit unions, people taking money out of B of A and so on and putting money into their local credit unions. Local credit unions have been thriving as a result. I could give more examples, but the bigger picture is we have more crises on the way. We have more opportunities to make these fundamental shifts, and the next time it could be different if we prepare ahead of time with more understanding, help more people to see what the alternatives are and why these breakdowns are happening at an increasing pace.
Yeah, and I want to piggyback just for a second on that and say that the will to act was clearly present among people who were either informed about the possibility of changing our economy and among people who were simply fed up with being beaten down by some of the poor habits that we've instituted in the economy. You know, the Occupy movement was really inspiring, and to see folks who had a strong will to act was heartening. So I think our task still remains to get widespread awareness of the economic situation we're in, the problem, and the list of solutions and policy changes that would, you know, basically take us from an economy that pursues more stuff to one that looks for better lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that not only was Wall Street so powerful, but they had this, what I keep referring to as an orthodoxy, and I keep thinking of, like, Galileo, and you know, he had the truth on his side and everything, but he had to recant because of the orthodoxy. I mean, they were going to torture and kill him. Probably what would happen to us is we just get ignored. But I think that perhaps the orthodoxy is starting to crumble. As you mentioned, Occupy is one of those things, and it's not just Occupy Wall Street, but a global phenomenon as well. But let's try and be as specific as possible about what kind of concepts we can have ready for this next crisis. I'm not sure who wants to begin on that.
Somebody well, I'd be in. Happy to state one thing that I'd really like to see, and that's that, you know, the economics that we're teaching our students in colleges and universities is all the orthodoxy that you're talking about, you know, the Ptolemy system of how the universe operates instead of the Galileo. So we're teaching students that growth is the ultimate goal, that that the financial system we've got in place it makes sense. And instead, what we really need is a shift to a lot more teaching of ecological economics. And, you know, I think of the ecological economists as the Copernicus types, the Galileos, who are seeing what's happening. And the reason they're able to do that is because most of them have training beyond your standard mainstream or what you'd call neoclassical economics. They have studied ecological systems, physics even, and so they combine a lot broader understanding of what's going on. And, you know, we need to get a much stronger foothold. In fact, when you say the term economics, it really ought to be talking about ecological economics. That's one place where I think we can start to make the turn.
Yeah, well, I couldn't
Richard,
agree.
Before you add your comment, let me just read one brief passage from Enough is Enough. The concept of steady-state economy has been developing for centuries. Economists have long considered a transition from a growing economy to a stable one. In the 18th century, Adam Smith anticipated such a transition. He believed that in the long run, population growth would push wages down, natural resources would become increasingly scarce, and division of labor would approach the limits of effectiveness. He even estimated that the period of growth would last for about 200 years. Okay, Richard, if you want to add something, please do.
Yeah, right. Well, here we are. Yeah, there are so many things that people can be doing right now to help prepare the economy of the future. And a lot of them are, you know, no-brainers and things that a lot of listeners are already doing. You know, helping to create a local food system, a local organic food system, supporting community markets and buying from local farmers is absolutely the bedrock of any economy is food. Then something I've been suggesting wherever I go is the idea, the idea of community economic laboratories. Every community already has, the basics of an alternative economy in a small form, whether it's, you know, a local food co-op or a credit union or a job center or some other kinds of cooperative enterprises. Well, why not bring them all together in one place in town? Maybe find an old heritage building, you know, that everybody looks to, that's kind of gotten, you know, it's currently vacant, and get everybody together, rent it out. And so when folks have time to volunteer or when they have needs that aren't being met, they know where to go. There may be car share programs already operating in the community, but nobody knows about them because they're, you know, the office is somewhere in one part of town, and you know, nobody's bothered to look. Well, why not just bring it all together in one place and announce it with a big event so that people know this? Hey, this is the foothold. This is where, this is the seed that from which the new economy is going to grow. And where that's happening, this is not a completely new idea, by the way, where that's happening in places in Canada and North America and Europe, towns are making faster progress. You know, it's easier for people to tune in and help out.
One of the things in the book that Post Carbon Institute put out, Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth, reminds us is that localization actually is relocalization. This is the way it has always been until very, very, very recently. And that's an important reminder. Robert, I know you must have some comments to add on to this, because a large part of what Enough is Enough is about this very thing.
Yeah, I mean, no question. I'm actually spinning around on Richard's idea of the economic laboratory, and I was thinking about it. I live in Corvallis, Oregon, and we're doing some of the exact things that he's suggesting, and I'm really excited. We've got an economic vitality team that's looking at localized food systems. And, you know, for instance, we have a lot of farms here, and we have a thriving farmers market, and it's really wonderful. But one thing that we don't have much of in Corvallis is the capability of food processing. So this this economic vitality team is looking into that, and it's really really wonderful to see. You know, there are, again, I'll echo what Richard said. There are tons of ways that you can plug in. You know, whether you want to start making the new economy yourself through local and sustainable enterprises, whether you want to take a role in activism and organizing. You know, if there are any students listening out there, it can be as simple as asking some profound questions to your professors. You know, if you're in an econ course, you know, throw out a challenge. You know, what are the prospects for continuing with this growth economy, and how can an economy that has already overgrown the capacity of ecosystems by 50%. How do we expect to fix that problem by trying to go the same route? You know, they're going back to what Richard was talking about with jobs. You know, we can start unplugging from the corporatocracy and be looking for jobs that are more meaningful to us, or some kind of alternative ways of meeting our needs than having a standard corporate job. You know, I'm not much of one, at least I try not to be much of one for prescribing what other people do, but certainly like telling people about some things that I've done, and one of the things, big changes that I've made in my life is I live in a co-housing community, and the idea behind that is getting together with a bunch of other households. You know, we still own our own unit. It's kind of like a condo in this village. You know, it's a little intentional community village is the way I think of it. And you know, an example of how
Robert, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt you, but we've reached the total end of our time. Obviously, this is a huge discussion, which will have to be done again and again and again. This is just the beginning. But we really appreciate your work and your joining us today. Robert Dietz, his book is Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And Richard Heinberg, thank you again for your many years of work, the clarity that you bring to it. This latest book that Post Carbon Institute has put out, Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth, is really important, really useful, and as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words and then some. Richard Heinberg, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joy, and thanks, Rob, and good luck with your book. It's a terrific book.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Thanks, Joy. You guys have a wonderful day, and keep up the great work.
Thank you both. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Ann Newport. I'm Joy LeClaire. Forthright Radio is made possible with a grant from the Alice and Alfred Adler Memorial Trust with the assistance of the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. And you can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com.